Hello and welcome back to Voicecraft. This podcast was recorded for the Voicecraft Network with members Zach Fishman, OG Rose, Cam Duffy and Aspasia KG. A little while on, we thought it would be worthwhile to share more broadly to any with interest in a slow-moving exploration of the intense themes of war and unity in our present moment. This is a totally different kind of interaction about topics of such importance to so many. Here there's time to ask questions, dwell in their significance, and share in the process of generative response, held in a context that protects the authenticity of that process. This was invited as a Culture Lab session, where members meet to connect and make sense of higher attention events and dynamics in culture and the world stage. If you're called to learn and contribute with us, you can learn about applying to the Voicecraft Network in the show notes. This is the second conversation we've had in response to the recent salience and tragedy of war stepping up in the last 6-7 weeks. Where are we? Almost near the end of November. Yes, yeah, about 6 or 7 weeks. I remember we met once in the wake of war beginning in Ukraine as well, which is a little while ago now. But in particular, this recent unfolding tragedy, you could wax lyrical with all the tragic words about what's unfolding, and feels a bit empty just to say that, but in some sense, there it is. The unfolding tragedy of human conflict continues in some important sense unabated, as if very little really has been learned over many, many, many years, centuries, millennia. Perhaps we can talk about some things which have in fact changed. But I imagine if you zoom in, there's more than enough evidence in the affect and the reality of what's occurring that has us rather connected anatomically as well as psychologically and in act to humans that have come thousands of years before us. And so, relating to that context in all of its very real and important identities and histories and stories, modern history and grievance and justice and desire for becoming, you look this way and that way, and it seems to me there's justification you can make over here and justification you can make over there, and it all amounts to something totally unjustified, and yet somehow we're speaking about something so tried, true and tested about the nature of human history that all of a sudden the whole thing is quite easy to explain, and yet impossible to explain, and yet quite easy to explain. And then impossible to explain. And we find ourselves in just this paradox of how do we actually relate here to the dynamics of what it means to be that which wars and be that for which war, in some sense, can always appear over the horizon to the degree that that intent is with someone else, in ourselves. And you know, in light of holding a session, an evening in person, where I believe there will be at least a number of representatives from Muslim communities, and perhaps as well from Jewish communities, and perhaps as well those who find themselves particularly attached to, let's say, one type of decolonial, anti-Western, anti-Zionist narrative, and then perhaps those who are wanting to understand just what that means a little bit more, and perhaps those who want to understand and relate with what it is to exchange energy in this context at all. So quite a melting pot, and so it's a privilege to have the opportunity to speak in this context with you guys. I have no expectations or particular intentions other than for sure to open the conversation to welcome in, what wants to be expressed in terms of questions and our own mode of relating with this now that we gather again 4 weeks after our previous conversation. I would, in fact, like to open up with a question. And if it doesn't get responded to immediately, I'll probably bring it back in. So I do invite it in some earnest with openness to go otherwise, which is just, what does unity mean to you? In what ways might it be helpful to communicate about that? What else ought we keep in mind and presence in heart when we relate to that notion? And perhaps we can approach then war somewhat obliquely, although I leave open anyone to hit the nail on the head, so to speak, if that's how you are called. So lovely to be here with you all, and just leave it open to the silence.
I'll jump in with a thought that comes to mind. There's something about unity that for me, it's a question of how to come into close proximity with one another, to have that level of closeness without annihilation of the individuals. There's something, I guess my mind goes to the overbearing mother. So the difference between unity as being something that that would promote something positive and useful, as opposed to being something that is, the words left me, but akin to annihilation, like the devouring mother, I guess, is the kind of thing I'm thinking of. I'm trying to figure out in my mind how I would differentiate those two things. So rather than a taking over, a somehow being together without a taking over. Those are just initial thoughts.
As a quick comment, I think unity is radically rare. It is much rarer than we realize. Usually it's simply the lack of conflict. What we call peace often in human history has actually just been a dominant hegemony, making it seem like peace sometimes. I almost wonder if we've ever known what unity is, as a sort of a provocative claim. I don't mean to say it's never existed, but I think it's something a lot rarer than we realize. And that actually perhaps periods of economic well-being has sort of made it seem like there's unity when really there's just passivity or people are too busy to fight. You know, you can have a sense of unity just because people are too busy to fight. And I wonder if actually, as just almost the human race has actually asked the question deeply on what is unity, as opposed to just these counterfeits of it. It's just a thought.
Yeah, I agree with that so much. And I think that's what I mean by, in my mind, it also brings in the element of closeness. It's not just about getting along. There's some unity sort of means a bringing together and a closeness without annihilation, without devouring, without, and I agree. I think in that, if I'm thinking about it in that way, I can't even come up with clear examples of what that would look like. So I agree that it would be very rare.
When I was on exchange at a university in America, I remember I was in an international relations class and we were talking about conflict and the future and what it might take for there to be a post-great power war world. It's kind of the question in the context of nuclear weapons, because that would seem like if those get used, that might be the end of the whole game, so to speak. So that game can't work. Can there be otherwise? And I remember at the time, in a rather predictable way, although this idea comes forward again and again, because I think it's a, I think it's a really important idea to grapple with. I remember speaking to the tutor after the class and he was in some agreement, but as if it was some outlandish thing. It's like, oh, maybe this is all we've got. And the idea was, well, maybe that what could enable that is some sort of alien invasion, right? There's some great other that requires unity among those that we want to be unified with. And so we can have a nice identity of belonging here with a common enemy. And how often has that been necessary? How much is that baked in to the notion of what it means to be in unity is an interesting question. I do sense that there are more mature, in some sense, more... Yeah, I think we can go with more mature. I think there are more mature ways to relate in that sense to what it is to share in an identity that can be in participation with another who shares enough in common so as to maintain the kind of communication that in some important sense has more capacity for exchange than war, or at least doesn't regress to that type of dynamic, in that sense that there is believed to be some mutual positive sum capacity to participate in building the kind of world that you and I and our children get to participate in. It's ultimately, how could we define war really? A kind of like, not you and your kids, or maybe your kids, but only if they're in some sense subservient to the will of me and my kids, something like that. So at least you and your kids and me and my kids, we can continue. And it does seem to, at least recognizing that forming identity, a kind of coherence of identity in relationship to something other, seems to be a kind of a basic philosophical notion to contend with. How important is this to recognize, and in what way does this influence how we show up in the public square to even seeking resolution to war? Do we, in identifying with the side that wants peace or wants ceasefire, are we so taken in by that experience of belonging and unity for the common cause of peace that in some sense we might already be stepping into a mode of relation that cannot but perpetuate the kind of dynamic which leads to, or if not is in fact, a kind of warring relation with the other tribe who is presumed to be the evil ones in whatever way we want to dress that up, the immoral ones. So something in there seems to be a very triggering thing to say, because I could imagine someone going, well, no, genocide. And it's like, of course, genocide. I am for a ceasefire. I am for a ceasefire. But then what? What are we? The conversation doesn't end there in some important sense. How are we relating to the total dynamic still? Surely a lot of many people can agree on no genocide. And yet, how much do we need to feel into what it is that wills toward genocide as last resort to actually properly relate with, where people genuinely feel themselves to be standing in a place of last resort? And that's a radical thing, to go down to the roots of relation, where one is in the pattern, in some sense, in the stuck, horrific, tragic pattern of engaging in such an act, often in a profound kind of, and here to use your excellent term, OG, a kind of profound self-effacement. I think we could see in many instances committing genocide unto a people and breeding in that sense a next era of hatred that only perpetuates that very same dynamic might be seen in some sense as a kind of self-effacement with respect to a transformative process between peoples. I don't know what you think about that, Daniel. But I'll stop there, having introduced some of the things which for me seem to be at the heart of some of the most difficult things to say and to be with.
Well, I'll just comment. I mean, the point on talking about unity when there's already a conflict already has a certain framing of, say, ceasing the conflict and therefore it's taking a side of it, which then already sort of suggests one side is right versus the other. And that's always kind of the problem that actually gets going. For me, the biggest tendency of the human race is to basically confuse peace with unity. And when there's peace, assume we're unified, thus do nothing with our free time to be prepared for encountering difference. And then once you enter into the conflict, to talk about unity there is taking a side of the conflict. So for example, if you talk about unifying, Israel and Palestine right now, right? Is there not a taking a political side of that, right? Or if you talk about unifying Ukraine and Russia, well, what does that look like? Russia would say you have to acknowledge them as their own state. Well, we don't want NATO on the border. So you've already got a dynamic at play once you talk about unity, right? And so that's always the problem. I was speaking with Thomas Jochen, and we talk a lot about the choice of how you use your free time is a moral choice. Like how you use your free time is actually a moral choice. And what we like to do in peacetime or when there's not a conflict is not use our free time to say habituate ourselves with difference or to talk about, you know, no one was talking about back in 2006, you know, let's go back to 2010 with the Russian economy, demographics collapsing, birth rates, all these different troubles. No one in the West was thinking about how to say support the Russian people so that they would not be in a situation where they may be more susceptible to a strong man, right? Well, that's when you'd actually have to be thinking about it. But we're, say, too busy in the West thinking about our own internals, because that's basically the tendency is when you have a peacetime, you think about your own nation to your own internals. You don't think about dealing with difference. And then when you have a conflict, you think about difference when it almost needs to be the reverse. Like it almost needs to be really thinking about how you're going to handle the encounter of difference or dealing with situations where there's no tension. So, for example, let me give an example. I think this example is unfortunately going to be very pronounced, hopefully not soon, but it could. So right now, you probably have an unbelievably massive housing bubble in China. America is not doing anything to sort of get ready for dealing or helping the Chinese or relating with the Chinese. In fact, they're the big evil country, right? You know, we have a totalitarian dictator and different things like that. Well, if the economy collapses, the government needs a scapegoat, we have a conflict then. And then once that gets going, it might be too late, right? Calls for unity are going to fall on deaf ears. Whereas right now, to sort of like talk about how to patch up connections with China and how to figure out how you might go about doing that without, say, compromising your moral compass, which becomes quite difficult. It would be now to start thinking about how to, say, separate the Chinese people from the Chinese government, because that's ultimately something you'd want to do, right? Like, how can you get the Chinese people to not be susceptible to the directions the government may push them, right? But that's not what we tend to think. We don't tend to think about those kind of things until a situation erupts. And then at that point, the frame is very difficult to fit because you have to take a side in the frame. Now, I'm not necessarily putting forth what I think is the best policy with China, but we don't even tend to think about these things in the peacetime because we confuse a lack of conflict with a sign of unity. And so then we don't do the work to try to actually have the unity. And this kind of suggests why history seems to repeat, right? I mean, what have we been talking about for the last 20 years? That there's no more war. Steven Pinker has that book, Better Angels, where violence is down. We basically stopped believing in the possibility of conflict, right? And we stopped thinking in terms of conflict and just took for granted the notion that if you spread capitalism, globalization, all these things, that you won't have conflict, right? So then you become complacent. And now you want to not be complacent, but you've kind of missed a bit of an episode. So those are thoughts that come to mind.
Thank you, Daniel. Can I be so bold as to ask you to comment, Cam? Because on this topic, I know you have plenty of thoughts, certainly on the meaning of unity. And I think it would be nice to, if you can, share any of those. Doesn't have to be long. But if there's anything you have to offer at this stage in the conversation, I think that will help us for the rest of it.
Yeah, thanks for your comments, everyone. I've just been trying to soak in these different frames that have been expressed and just see what arises within myself as I try and sort out, I guess, how to relate to this in an ongoing way. And, you know, a lot comes up, and I find myself, I mean, the word unity is one that seems to be, for me, it leads to an exploration of the nature of consciousness in a sense, because, you know, there's, if we really evolve a sociobiology of consciousness and use the word unity in that context, what do we have? We've got stages of development, we've got survival imperatives, we've got existential imperatives when it comes to co-regulating, coming together, creating an order of survival, you know, modes of communication that enable that order to be sustained. And you've got that which is beyond that order. We've got that kind of looking outward and othering, and the, at a primitive level, the implicit sense of threat and uncertainty when we encounter another. And, you know, when we've got these different sociological programs developing under different conditions and coming together, it's very challenging to, without dialogos, it's, and without the means by which we can be initiated into self-awareness, you know, individually and culturally, it seems like the projection of the shadow, the escalation of tensions are simply there to play out, because evolution fundamentally needs to establish a order of development, and it has to establish that in the context, in the ecological context. And if there's scarcity there, right, we've got the priming for tensions and membranes forming and the allocation of resources in accordance with that which is a threat versus, I guess, as Daniel was mentioning, you know, in peacetime, what are we really doing? You know, what are we really doing in peacetime? Are we simply falling into some pre-established primal sense of meaning, or are we actually working on what it means to be? You know, I mean, there's just so much loaded into that, but the gravity is always going to be towards that which can be provoked, or tends towards that sense, as long as the scarcity of who is the threat and how do we strategize against the threat. And the, obviously, it's just so many layers there of obscurity and potential obfuscation and gaming. And without dialogos and without initiations into self-awareness and modes of being that enable something other than the gravity of, you know, the primitive drives to simply overwhelm the faculties, it's so difficult to not get untangled from the chaos and actually progress in order in relation that allows for something that isn't simply one unity versus another unity, but a sense that we're all in this together. And, you know, communication is just such a primary thing here when it comes to how we relate to one another. And how does communication actually work, right? How does it work across membranes? You know, there's so much to be said for the function of certain initiatory imprints for people actually coming together and overriding the rigid aspects of their conditioning, so that we understand we're actually of all the same existential nature. And until we get to that level of depth, the gravity is going to pull us into those dynamics, no doubt, under the tensions that naturally unfold in economic contexts where people are having to ramp up fundamental physiological tendencies just to survive day to day, right? Our culture runs on cortisol, noradrenaline, dopamine. I don't think that's sufficient. You know, we need to bring a bit more into that. And I didn't mean to be too reductionistic in that context, but you know, there's real things to contend with here if there was to be the actualization of human beings. And it's never guaranteed, is it really? It's something that we're being challenged with on a daily basis, individually and with each other, under really difficult circumstances when it comes to where we take this situation.
Thank you, Cam. Zach, I noticed you developed a bit of a habit of talking right at the end and opening things up in an extremely interesting direction. So I'm in the business of prodding just a little bit today. I'd love to hear if anything's grabbed you so far.
Sure. Well, I think I would take things in a slightly different direction if I were to speak now, but to do that, the only way that I can relate to the conflict going on in Israel is through the lens of the rival brothers, right? Which is a metaphor, which has been, I'm not the first one to use this metaphor for those two peoples, right? And that's a particularly salient metaphor for me because I grew up in that dynamic. You know, I mean, I've got an older brother and we used to just like fight all the time, right? And there was never unity, right? I understand what Daniel means. Like there's times when we weren't fighting, but there was never any unity, right? Where it was always just waiting for the next conflict, right? And like I can see, again, not to in any way belittle the what's going on in Gaza, and you know, obviously what I experienced as a kid doesn't relate in terms of its intensity and its magnitude to getting your house bombed and not having clean water, but I can see some of the same structures at play, right? Like when you listen to people argue about Israel and Palestine, what you hear a lot of is, well, they started it, right? And like, I know that game, right? And as the younger brother, what I'm inclined to say is that it doesn't matter who started it. What matters is that he's bigger and stronger and he's hurting me, mom, right? And yet, I also understand as the younger brother that if you go and flick your brother's ear and run away, he's not going to respond with proportional force, right? He's not going to chase you down and flick your ear as hard as you flicked his ear. He's going to chase you down and tackle you and rub your face in the dirt and pound on your chest until you completely break down and lose your shit, right? And so the question, I guess, could be like, why does the younger brother go and flick the older brother's ear? And the answer is because if he doesn't do that, the older brother just takes up all of the space and doesn't allow him to have any identity for himself, right? So like the typical scenario is that the older brother and younger brother are watching TV together and the younger brother says, hey, can we watch what I want to watch? And the older brother says, nope. Right? And the younger brother says, why not? And the older brother says, because I have the controller, right? And the younger brother says, well, can I have the controller for a while? And the older brother says, yeah, come and get it, right? And so like, as the younger brother, what are you going to do? You're just going to live with that? Like, you're just going to be like, okay, fine. We're going to do your world, right? And I can't have any control of the space. No, you're going to do whatever you'll say, okay, we can't watch what I want to watch, but you're not going to get to watch what you want to watch either, right? And so I'm just going to, it's a suicide mission, but fuck you, right? That's the dynamic. And I get it at that level. Again, I don't claim to understand war in its fullest reality, but that dynamic seems to be at play here, right? So the question then to come to unity is like, how do you achieve unity from that situation? And what it took for me and my brother was, first of all, space, right? He moved out. We're 4 years apart. So I entered high school the same year that he entered college, and he went to college like 20 minutes from where I grew up. And so we had some space, and then we had a common purpose. We started climbing together. And through climbing, we were able to put aside our rivalry and orient our energy towards a common purpose, right? And integrate it into that common goal of climbing together. Because if we, you know, if we got into our fights, then the climbing trip would devolve and we both wanted to climb more than we wanted to fight. And so we were able to put that aside and achieve a kind of unity as climbing partners, right? We still fight sometimes, you know, it's not a perfect unity. But so that, to me, like that's what you need, is you need clear boundaries, and then you need a common purpose that you can unite in from within those boundaries. But I think Daniel's point is so spot on about like the difference between a lack of conflict and unity, right? And again, what Tim was saying about how like a call for peace can really be disguised as a call for domination, right? Like going back to the TV situation, it's like, you know, my older brother would say, well, I'm just trying to watch TV in peace and he's annoying me, right? And so a call for peace can be a disguised call for a continuation of tyranny. That's where I would take it.
I found that extremely helpful. Thank you. You know, I'm feeling a challenge now because I think we've done a really good job of laying out a lot of what is at stake here, or a lot of the dynamics in play, a lot of the challenges, a lot of the perennial difficulties and different stories and frames to see it through. There's one additional one, or at least there's probably several, I suppose, but one that comes to mind, which is, I think, an even more incendiary thing to say. And to be totally honest with you, I feel it won't be my role to say this tomorrow. If this gets brought in by others, I'll be there in a different sort of way. But it's to introduce, you know, we can recognize the treatment of the Palestinian people by the Israelis, the conditions in Gaza, that situation over the last 70 plus years. And it matters to recognize that, and the felt dynamics of being oppressed by a much more powerful oppressor, a younger brother by an older brother. I think that's a fair analogy to make, and only magnified in its crudeness and absurdity when you zoom into some aspects of it. And then I am aware, fully aware of the perspective of, you know, Jews that I've known, who I've related with at a deep level, who might feel that, well, how can we be safe unless we create these conditions of such control? Because we know, we believe that they want to, well, do to us what happened on October the 7th. And even if we say not all of them, and of course, not all of them, but certainly the governing political group. And then we can say, well, that governing political group was supported by the Israeli government at some point because they, you know, so the argument goes, they didn't want a more two-state friendly solution governing body to be in power because actually they wanted a greater Israel that was always and forever controlled by the Jewish ethnicity as well as religion. And here I want to bring in the religious piece, because this is, I think it's a mistake in some sense to see this as a situation only of ethnicity onto ethnicity oppression. There is also the religious aspect. Now, of course, these things become very much entwined with each other over deep history, and maybe nowhere is there as much entwining. I suppose perhaps you can look at indigenous populations and what have you, although things have brought in quite a lot of perturbation to that over the last few hundred years, as we know, in tragic ways. But we have a situation where there has in fact been an a selected for ethnicity that has been supported by, to be a little too basic about it, the software of religious system, of religious ideas. I don't really want to get stuck in the hardware software thing here at all, but there is something helpful about recognizing something helpful for at least a short while about the metaphor of an operating system. And I say this to recognize the narrative in this ecology. You might have someone like Sam Harris be a particularly articulate speaker of this, which will make claims as to Islam, and certainly in its more extremist interpretations, as being something equivalent to a death cult. That is the claim that's made, and that's a claim that's in there in the psychological space for Muslim people to relate to, which is full on as something to relate to before we even engage in the process of understanding at all. And I can fully understand why the human being as part of a loving familial unit and community wants to just reject even the very affect of that when heard outright. And yet I think it is relevant to recognize that the human being can come, whatever the creed, to a belief system so thoroughly held that sees essentially any sacrifice, the life of oneself, the life of others, as wholly justified in a context of, let's say, jihad, or at least some divine commandment. Or there's like a better word for that. And so, let's say some divine mission, some purpose. And we have here, in some sense, the possibility for purpose to become entrenched and stuck in the playing out of a way that is incommensurate with the kind of mutual valuation of two who are different in ethnicity and religion to live among each other in a way that is consistent with the kind of set and setting necessary for the kind of dialogical exchange that you're mentioning, Cam, for instance. And it seems to me that in recognizing the reality of this, my orientation is to say we have to recognize ourselves in a multi-generational situation across a vast expanse of time where we can hold in some sense to ideals of relationship and how we orient ourselves in relative peacetime or relative peace bubbles, while at the same time, in some sense, not shutting our eyes to the reality of a certain kind of contradictory, necessarily frictionful, hellish type situation. And that seems to demand, in response, a fullness of energetic orientation and capacity where a tremendous amount of values and virtues are capable of coming into some process of affirmation in their time, while at the same time not in their individual affirmations breaking off into something cancerous or something that perpetuates the system to be worse. And in some respects, it's partly one of the reasons why I've wondered about whether or not engaging with topics like this might in fact need an altogether entirely different membranic framing or invitational structure let's say, than what even has been, you know, I put forward in the context of the public voicecraft events. I haven't like screamed them from the rooftops. And one hopes that the signaling out there is effective at bringing together a group of people who can enter into some process that makes something worthwhile of that experience. And yet, truly, the radicality of relating with what's at stake here, and this is one of the reasons why, it's the final thing I'll say, one of the reasons why I sort of made the effort to sort of ask you guys to watch that video with Les, the long conversation. Because that conversation, the story near the end of that, or two-thirds of the way through, where he recounts the story of the Neville saying, jab the wife, tranquilize the wife, in that situation where one could be forgiven for thinking that she's the one who's calming the situation down, where her husband is there with a long knife screaming that he wants to kill her and slashing away at a wall. And yet there's something profoundly radical, without making a state claim about whether or not such a thing was right, so far away from the context. But the claim there is something like, they're in such conditions of profound radicality, such violent eruption and possibility for the largest stakes to, you know, turn to the very worst, that the discernment in such a situation might feel so many, so counterintuitive, and yet to act in a way so as to influence the situation into something other than the perpetuation of that stuck energy, which is for our sakes here seen as the perpetuator of the violent and apparently irrecoverable situation. Is there, can we turn this different angle? Is there free energy in the context? Is there a way to even consider such is a kind of radical type of relating that it seems to me is totally not sanctioned, promoted, enabled in our peacetime contexts, in our context seeking such safety. I don't see how we can relate with such a profound situation of radical violence if, in some sense, to many onlookers, there won't also appear a kind of radical madness to the healing and what it means to engage in that act. And to even presence that is a wild complexity of thing to presence. So, yes, thank you.
Well, I'll just note, and thank you, Mr. Haibu, for your framing and what you just said. You know, going through, because I think what Haibu was saying is a very good metaphoric structure to think to the issue. A way to think about that is ultimately, in game theory, they talk about Nash equilibrium. And what that is when everyone does what's rational, you get a suboptimal result, or rationality can't get you through. Actually, another term I actually like to call Nash equilibrium rational impasses. It's an impasse for rationality. So if that's the case, because basically what we see is there is no way, the world has not figured out basically how to do international relations other than what's called a realist framework. Ultimately, it becomes a realist framework. We like to talk about liberal value, and it just ultimately falls back in different things. Now, it should be noted that Francis Fukuyama's entire theory at the end of history was the notion that basically capitalism would be the rock climbing with your brother, like you were saying, like we would unify by it, we'll do business together, then we won't fight anymore. And because we like to make money, that won't happen. And there's actually a very strong argument to be made that that's a pretty strong case that economics tend to work very well. The fallacy is the following. And Fukuyama is actually a lot smarter than people realize. He's actually quite an intelligent fellow in the book. He even realizes this problem that Raymond and Joshua and other people, it's called thymos. And in the classic soul, there's three components that you have to address for humans to be fully human, if you will. You have to address eros, logos, and thymos. Eros, consumption, sex, pleasure. logos, rationality, and things like that. But thymos gets into culture, it gets into religion, beliefs, fight, rising to the occasion, and so on and so forth. The theory of capitalism was that if you give people enough eros, they'll get over their thymos and it will just gradually go away, actually. And if you train them enough in logos, they'll also realize that thymos is irrational and will go away. I think that theory is over. Thymos never goes away. It's always lurking. And if you push it down, it will come back. And here's the problem. Capitalism has no good address. And this is what Belonging again tried to argue, is that capitalism has no good address for thymos. And yet it seems to be the best way to deal with the problem of international conflict. Well, then we have an issue because we have no way to deal with the Nash equilibrium of these conflicts when they arise. And if the best way to keep them from happening has an expiration date, then we have a massive, massive problem that has to be thought. Now, the only way you overcome a Nash equilibrium, to your point, Tim, is what the non-rational, not the irrational, but a non-rational action. That's how you get through a Nash equilibrium. Someone has to do something that looks irrational to everyone else, but they actually know it's non-rational, which is different from irrational, even though it looks irrational to everyone, because that's the only way to break through the stronghold. Think about the prisoner's dilemma. Think about that scene in A Beautiful Mind, all of these different things. It is incredibly different to do the non-rational in a world with television information, because remember, to everyone outside the choice, what is non-rational looks crazy or irrational or foolish. This puts a particular level of pressure on global leaders and different people like that. But the notion of a wild wisdom, I mean, I think you can argue very clearly in game theory that a wild wisdom is the only way to break through Nash equilibrium. So the following becomes, what would be the non-rational in the Ukraine-Russian situation, in the Israeli-Gaza situation? Sometimes I also think, as a note, and we don't have to go in this direction, sometimes I think it can help to think about situations like this to create a kind of different hypothetical. And the one I've been talking to people about is, so right now, China is building a whole lot of factories in Mexico. They have a lot of like manufacturing and different things. And let's imagine the Chinese started putting a military base in Mexico to defend the factories from the drug lords. They say, it's not about America, it's about defending our workers from some of the drug cartels. How would America respond? What would be the unified thing to do? What would be the avoiding war to do? It's very easy for Americans to look at Ukraine and say, no, Russia shouldn't do this or that, or Israel and Gaza shouldn't do this and that. But imagine it's your nation and your border, and you want to avoid conflict. This actually brings out the intensity and difficulty of this kind of problem. Because if you put the military bases there, aren't you putting all the lives in jeopardy in, say, Texas or Arizona or, different parts of the world, Southern California and different things? These are very difficult to think. But if we're going to figure out a new non-rational way to approach these problems, I think framing it that way and asking Americans, what does that look like? You go from there. I mean, you could also kind of argue that that's what pacifism was supposed to be. It's kind of wild and crazy, but you say, I'll let myself get killed, in order to avoid these kind of Nash equilibrium situations. The problem with pacifism is most people ask the question, would I be willing to die to stop conflict? Well, would you let your daughter die to stop conflict? Because that's a much more different ballgame. It's easy to talk about you dying for your beliefs, but what if I'm not going to kill you, I'm going to kill your family or your friends? Isn't it immoral? Isn't suddenly pacifism monstrous? You see, these are what we have not thought. And I think that's what we have not thought, so we have not been ready for these kind of things. But those are some thoughts that come to mind. I appreciate all the framings that have come forth.
Really well said, Daniel. That really tied a number of things together. I have, in some sense, it's partly an intellectual question, and I think it is grounded in intuition. This non-rational, or what appears as non-rational, it would seem as though I can absolutely make sense of the usage of the term non-rational when indicating that move, which was not, let's say, could not be validated from the perspective of the Nash equilibrium. And yet from the person making that move, I do have a sense that that comes from a place of knowing, comes from a kind of intuition that part of me reaches to make sense of through a framing of a perception of pattern, a perception of a gestalt, a perception of a whole that could be realized from potential, which all of a sudden brings into it a kind of something which we could also call a rational move to make. And so is it the case that non-rationality is specifically being used to refer to the perspective of the previous stuck situation, the stuck Nash equilibrium space? And so in some sense, what you're talking about is kind of like the transformation of the available framing of for the majority, such that the non-rational move can now be made sense of as rational participation, but we need not, from a philosophical perspective, consider it non-rational in some absolute fundamental sense. Okay,
absolutely. You know, the funny thing is, rationality is only possible because of something non-rational, like an emotion or something, an experience or what you believe is true. The funny thing is, the moment you think about the non-rational, you translate it into rational terms, making it seem like there was only rationality ever at play. This key for me, you know, that's why we call our trilogy The True Isn't the Rational, because the distinction between true and rational is, in my opinion, basically that distinction from missing from logic and epistemology is one of the reasons we're actually so unprepared for these situations, because we have no way to move out of Nash equilibrium. The true isn't the rational. You know, another way to think about it is, you know how Ian McGilchrist will talk about awareness and your modes of awareness, and then that determines how you think about things. Awareness, and you can think of Simone Weil, Ivan Illich, awareness is non-rational, but it is the very horizon that makes rationality possible, because it is according to which you use your thinking and logic, right? So for example, if in The Prisoner's Dilemma, you realize that what seems like the most rational situation actually isn't possible, and you're aware of that, suddenly what becomes rational is what seems to be less rational, but actually it's the most rational because you understand the entire problem, right? So that's the issue. What constitutes the best move depends on your awareness of, say, the gestalt. You could talk about wisdom, the experience. And we basically, in all honesty, because we have not been taught this distinction, we in our personal lives are in trouble. We can't overcome Nash equilibrium. In international relations, we're in huge trouble because we can't overcome Nash equilibrium. And once we get into these situations, we don't know how to get out of them, because we don't even have the category of something alternative to rationality that I'm calling non-rationality as a third. And then I'll close my point. Forever, we've said there's rationality and irrationality. The argument is there's a third category. There's rational, irrational, and non-rational. And the non-rational is the very basis that makes rationality possible. And that brings to like what Cam was saying about consciousness. You could talk about empathy. You can talk about thinking across religions. You can think about like, wait a minute, older brother, small brother. Oh, wait a minute. That's like a situation they can't escape. That very ability to see different frames, that would entirely be non-rational, because relative to what frame you think determines what is rational. And you see, here's the problem. If you can only think one frame, which is what most people on this planet can only do, because that's all they've been taught to do, then you're stuck in whatever is rational for that frame. And if what's rational for that frame is a Kafka story, or it's something that has no good result, then there's no way to escape. And that's what we have found ourselves in international relations, basically.
Yes, understood. It's nice to have that clarification. If I had to take a test of O.G. Rowe's philosophy, I would have given that answer, but it's nice to get the clarification, because we've been kind of running that mind together, I think, for a number of years. I think there are many people who recognize the criticality of what you're naming here as the non-rational. But I do find that there's an issue of discourse here, or a meaningful difference in discourses, and it is always curious to me the kinds of words that are likely to have the effect of, in fact, opening someone to the realization of the virtues and the necessities of the non-rational. That might be someone who's potentially really, I could imagine someone be open to that potentially, who's really grounded in thinking about rationality and irrationality, and they arrive at a point and intellectually they're like, there's the expansion. But yes, I do think, you know, as you mentioned, wisdom in that third category, you know, that which has, you know, the kind of like a grounds of intelligibility as such, an orientation or awareness. I often think in terms of orientation as that capacity to, anyway, so it's nice to have that clarification. Yes, I'll stop there because
Well, I'll just make a comment. One of the reasons we call it the non-rational is because when you make that choice, it feels scary, stupid, and non-rational from a phenomenological basis. Like, by if you called it, now we also call it the true, but the problem is the true sounds nice and strength and really comfortable and like you want to do it. But actually the key is in the actual individual experience of making a non-rational choice, it feels like you're crazy. And it feels like you're alone, and it's emotionally very difficult. That's why people do not do it. And the problem is when we call it things, I know some people have used the term transrational, that feels transcendent and nice and like you're above the fray, but that's actually not how you experience it at the time. You experience it as you're crazy, and people will actually call you crazy and stupid. And so you have to more align it for me from the phenomenological experience of literally what is non-rational that you know is actually the only way to experience as the Nash equilibrium is what everyone around you will easily call irrational, and you're in the wrong. And if you're not emotionally ready for that because you've languaged it in a way to make you emotionally ready for that, you'll probably break. And you'll probably actually lose faith, and you'll lose courage and your own sort of commitment to that. So that's one of the reasons for the stress on the term non-rational. Also, it's non-rational because it is not calculatable by a rational calculus. So it is outside a rational calculus, and then you do it. But we do like to, in our language, emphasize the individual experience. And if and that, and you have to be ready to feel like it's crazy. You have to be ready to feel like you can't explain it. And you have to be ready for the courage that takes. So it's true, by saying non-rational can be confusing, but it's confusing when you make a non-rational choice. Yes, it feels difficult and you require that. So that's one of the reasons. It's a fair point though.
No, I think that's a powerful argument. And I fully take that on board. My only response to that is, I think at a certain point, one can come to the awareness of the way in which truth burns, at which point one, I think, can use the word truth in such a way that doesn't have that same, in a sense, there's a kind of, to the degree one has lived a non-rational move, then we could potentially make a relation there to the notion of the post-tragic. I think there's a pre-tragic and then tragic in it, and then it becomes language anyway. And then the other thing, but putting that to the side, because this is a question I've had for a long time, that the whole notion of mutually assured destruction, in some sense, this is a kind of gaming out to a point of rational calculus does not further, but if we'll just hang out in the city. We're kind of hanging out in the peace that has been generated by the fact that we've gone to the limits of what the present game can do, but we're not actually engaging in the radical act that could be otherwise. And so we're hanging out in that kind of false peace in some sense. And yet, I mean, I do wonder about this, you know, because it does seem to me, you know, some people, it seems, have come, like Greg Henriquez is one of these. He seems to be the kind of person, part of his story seems to involve, he sort of tells it through the mind, that him coming to, let's say, an appreciation for the transcendent was something which was stoked by a particular kind of intellectual journey. And then they're involved something, otherwise we can say some It would be curious. I am, because I'm often wondering, you imagine the effective altruist type people, like so much of the world runs on that utilitarian, if only we could come to that rational calculation. And it is curious to me, or, you know, I've spoken to people who, and I've been a person, you know, mired in nihilism at a young age, and speaking to people who might be in that mode in their 20s and later, of course. And it seems there's, you know, it's a powerful intellectual construct that's been developed there. And there's often this motivation. I don't hold it too strongly. I generally go another way, but a motivation to be like, if only that could be addressed at the level at which that is essentially the limits of what you can say about that rationally indicate the coming to an immediate end of a life supportive game under that framing. So, and then all of a sudden there's a performative contradiction of here we are relating with each other, and it continues in some sense. So yeah, it's curious about where I'm going with this, and I sense I've maybe spoken a little too long here, is just that I wonder about the portals through to connecting with someone when that moment of, let's say, a transcendent turn, a non-rational move, however we want to frame it, a reframing, a ending of the trance, which is a nice way I think about the transcendency with that wordplay, the ending of the trance of that previous rational frame. It seems like we are seeking, to the degree we're interested in what type of initiation, what type of cultural process, what type of invitation structure, what of that, and we've got many things to say about this, but in some sense we are, I think, attempting to stay in real touch with what can this look like now in our culture now, where actually are the likely pathways that we can plan to meet people in and in some sense cater for, prepare for, right? So that we can meet, okay, it's actually people go through this pathway given the certain development of the Western mind in this context. How non-rational are we talking? You know what I mean? How much are we going to play in to affirming the rational, the stakes at play in the present Nash equilibrium, which is kind of what we did at the beginning of this conversation and some of what I bring to things. Let us share some of the narratives that are held so importantly, that are affirmed and taken on as part of an identity. Because to the degree we're not affirming those, well, someone can say, well, you haven't considered this. Now, you can't consider everything in some important sense, and that will break down. But you see what I mean? There's a certain sense of how much does one meet the rational mind where it sat with all its fixation to its justification, bled into by the heart in some sense, and then what, like, enabling that turn otherwise is a very interesting thing.
First of all, I really enjoyed that last exchange about the non-rational. That clarifies a lot. That really helps me understand that concept and what you're talking about with that, Daniel. So thank you for that. And I want to maybe bring it back to what Tim was talking about earlier about, like, trying to bring the religious context into this conflict and the way that it is religious in nature and not merely about land. Because I think that that's a really good insight that, like, you can frame it as just a battle over land. And in many ways, it is. But, like, it's also a battle of identity, right? And it's like, under the Ottomans, from what I understand, I don't know that much about it, but from what I understand, there was generally peace between Arab Muslims and Jews in that land under Ottoman rule, right? And I think that the Ottoman thing, like, they were an empire, right? So their thing was basically like, look, you guys can have your mosque over there, you guys can have your synagogue over there, just pay your taxes and get along, and you don't have to, like, become Ottoman in any like meaningful sense, right? There wasn't that much of, like, an imposition of identity, right? But now that it's become Israel, there's this question, right, of is Israel a state for Jews, or is it a Jewish state, right? And it's very interesting that the founders of Zionism were mostly secular Jews, right? Theodor Herzl was a secular Jew. And he obviously played on the narrative of the return to the homeland, but he was a secular guy, right? And so it's like, ever since then, there's been this like tension of, is it like, because if it's a Jewish state, then it should be governed according to the Torah and the law of the rabbis. And like, you know what I mean? There should be that structure in place. And if it's a secular state, if it's supposed to be like Canada, then there shouldn't be any of that, right? It should just be like, it doesn't matter what your religion is. It doesn't matter what your national identity is. Like Canada, Trudeau said that Canada is a post-national state, right? And this speaks to me what Daniel was saying about thymos, that it's like today there's, and this is that where the non-rational comes in too, is that we have, people have this framing where they think of nation as merely like land plus governance, right? Whereas nation in the ancient sense is like a people, right? It has this whole thymotic element, right? It's got all this like culture and history and all this other stuff attached to it. It's not merely a governmental structure. And so I think that the like making that move to meet people is really important in this conversation, because you have people who are talking about the nation of Israel as if a nation should merely be a secular governance over an arbitrary boundary of land, whereas you have other people talking about nationhood in terms of like, you know, the Cherokee nation, right? Which is like this spiritual identity. And so, yeah, I don't know exactly, like, I don't know, I've ran out of steam here. I don't know how to connect that back, but I just wanted to connect back to the religious element there.
Can I just jump in quickly? It's just a short comment, but I've been thinking about this and I think it finally ties in enough. I'll share it now. To go back to the sibling rivalry thing that you were talking about, I think there's also the most universal sort of compelling version of that rivalry is the rivalry of siblings for their parents, right? And that's, I guess what I'm referring to is that we also need to take into account the health or the sickness of the parent, right? So are they going to, is there a context in which these siblings have the opportunity to learn to coexist, that that's nurtured, or is the sickness of the parent who desires that they have a favorite or desires their children to, you know, bid for their time, is that going to be a relevant factor too? So there's, I think there's also a role to play of, it's not really the observers, but the others as well outside of the two siblings. Like there's something to think about. Competitiveness is natural, I guess, in a developmental sense, it's natural. But in a developmental sense, is also the role of the parent who is supposed to assist that process. Otherwise, you will end up with siblings who, and you know, it's not always an explicit experience that their parent is unhealthy and their parent is goading them to be competitive with one another. They might think the opposite, but under the hood, that may be what's going on. And then, you know, siblings learn to do all sorts of things. They learn to cut off parts of themselves and start to, you know, identify with these other aspects that they know is going to be pleasing to the parent or is like the parent, so that, you know, they lose their, I guess, what you might call their otherwise true identity that could have emerged, could have developed. It gets molded and modified. I'm not entirely sure how that's relevant here, but it seemed like an important thing to add in.
Sorry, Zach, but if you want to rip on that,
you go ahead.
I thought that might be a point that I could transition to an expansion. And so there's, you know, that frame of, you know, we do lose parts of ourselves in order to conform and survive in that attachment context and developmental context. And that's very complex as you sort of really get into the finer details through consecutive work with different examples of what is going on in systems. especially family systems. And part of when I was listening to that, I was also thinking about the animus-like projections of young people in societies at large with religious frameworks, and how people want to conform with that, and the when there are moral imperatives there, right, that give you a sense of resolution from your shame or your guilt, or you know, there's so much developmental complexity into how that can play out in a way that leads to compulsive tendencies and influences motivation in a very primal way. You know, you can only go so far before you need to kind of meet certain developmental needs in that relational context, and then you can go further. And this is all development of identity, right? And so if we were to look at an ideal situation where we didn't have this relationship with the animus, or and if we had a real mature sense of developing a real deep sense of embeddedness and our entanglement with each other beyond the capture of these forces in a manner that is quite rigid and closing off of potential, I think again, like initiations and this idea of the non-rational. And what I was thinking of with that is a kind of surrender to the prehensive. And it's almost like letting go of ourselves as a noun, because so much of human development seems to be about developing this stable sense of self. You know, it's a first step. It's a first essential developmental step. But as soon as you've got that, you've got a, oh, this is me and this that is you, and this is what I have the imperative to defend. And, you know, other cultures and, you know, traditions have developed more of a concept of a verb, of self as verb. So more of a process. And so there's more of a dynamicism to the surrender and to the trust and the real, the deep kind of manifestation of that process, and less of a need to really grasp the point where we're burning our hands on the rope, which is just not getting anywhere, right? There's just a lot loaded in that, I'm very sure. I mean, I think part
Can
of
I add
the
a piece in there, Cam, and then just hand it right back to you. The holding, the distinction between holding and sharing space, I wonder if you find that appropriate to weave in there, because something that we've spoken about before, you know, I've been mentioning it in different psychedelic contexts. I do think that the orientation towards holding, because the government says it's okay, we're going to make it safe for everyone, I would see a relation there between holding a conception of the self as a noun, well, in terms of holding space, and there is a kind of, there is much more of a radicality to relating as process, if we're talking about what it, like a dynamism of surrender. There is, and if we're talking about process philosophy, we are speaking about that which is affirming its nature as creation in participation and its ingression into novelty, such that when we do interact, we are in fact bringing something in to the history of the universe which matters and necessarily informs and influences that which comes after it. And so in that sense, we have, there is a birthing, there is a genuine birthing, and we can share in that lineage and we can share in that onwards movement, but we can't contain it from the perspective of that which was previously holding. Like the blockchain has gone on, the blockchain is developed. We can talk about the meaning of holding in a sense. I'm not trying to say holding doesn't have a place in this very dynamic, but I was just curious for the sake of the document of this artifact to have that in there. I think the language of holding space is actually holding a little bit back in terms of how people are relating to actually relating with the transformative and actually relating with the non-rational.
I think if I were to sort of match that somewhat with Nash equilibrium and smashing that fixation or problem, it seems to me that there needs to be initiation into symbolic death, because with symbolic death, there's an expansion of potential beyond that consolidated grasp. You know, it's that grasp is just one you know, it's like Jung's notion of the transcendent functional, going between different paradigms or self models of what is possible, and, you know, ultimately in relational contexts. And so with the symbolic death, there's a real opportunity, to the degree to which that is, you know, wisely cultivated, to actually expand potential and realize that, you know, we can self-realize a sense of potentiality through the prehensive. And how that unfolds relationally, there's a lot in there that, you know, there's some hope in all of this. It's just that obviously the practical aspects of this, there needs to be a will to more than power, a will to meaning in a more integrative way that is conducive to that which is in constant process and relating on that level. And so there's obviously complexity to this. And, you know, I'm just saying all these words, but all these words, the way in which we relate to them and how that relation plays out in our lives has real consequences. And I guess what we're doing right now is potentiating a lot of this opening to what is still there to be actualized, or what can be explored as a way to kind of provoke or invite a new way of being, perhaps. I'm mindful that Zach wanted to say something earlier. I'm just wondering if that is on your mind at the moment.
Well, yeah, maybe just very quickly. Like, I just, when Asfa Sio was talking about the, like, where's the parental dynamic in that whole metaphor, it just struck me that, like, that's, you could think about that as like the UN and like the media and sort of just like public opinion, right? Because that's where like Israel and Palestine are vying for who's the favorite, right? And I've actually heard this language that, forget who it was, some talking head was saying that Israel is like the UN's spoiled favorite child, right? And so I definitely think that that dynamic is at play, that they're both trying to win over the affection and the sort of the favoritism of the world as such. You know, I mean, whoever controls the power dynamics in that region. I just made that connection. I just wanted to say that.
Well, I'll jump in. And then alas, I have a business commitment I have to run to, but this has been fantastic. Basically, what we've done in education and school is teach the rational. If you teach the rational, then you just keep arriving back at rational impasses time and time again. What we have to do is start teaching the non-rational at the same time. If you have autonomous non-rationality, you're in trouble. If you have autonomous rationality, you're in trouble. You need both. If you and we have to start teaching that. And basically, not that anyone would ask me, but if I was king of the world, I would basically have all children all the time constantly talking with other children of other countries. You're going to be able to do this with AI translating technology, with Zoom technology. I don't see why they can't have the kids of other countries be their teachers, because what you must do is teach a different mode of awareness as early in life as possible. Because the thing is, once you get older, right, you see, rationality is kind of like, it grows on top of non-rationality and it becomes very solid, very hard to break through. And once they get older, it's very different to change it. But if you can have children, because basically what's going to be the point of learning geography if I can have ChatGPT, right? If I can like have AI tell me all this information, what's the point? The thing that we could prioritize is by attuning children very early on to different emotional connections to different people of other religions and cultures. Because one of the number one things you can do to create connections is foreign students, you know, transfers to international students, embassies, all of these different things go a lot. Like, when did American and Chinese relations collapse? When the international students, that all collapsed. When Americans stopped going over there, Chinese stopped coming to America. And then the Chinese who came to America stopped going back. You know, they just started staying in America. That was a huge problem. Like, why can we not have elementary kids talking with kids in the middle? Like you have 1 week where you're talking to kids in the Middle East, 1 week where you're talking in Africa, and go through African history, go to Middle Eastern. Ivan Illich makes a point that we for too long have assumed you can only do education with teachers. I think that's true. You may not need as many teachers as you think, just spaces where children are constantly interacting with one another. And then when they're 30 years old and they're later, they'll remember those people of the other religions and other nationalities actually have value as persons, and that there are other modes of consciousness, because you will have given a non-rational education at the same time you gave a rational education. And basically, and if that sounds absurd, like that's all non-rational address must sound absurd. That's why we call it non-rational. It has to sound a little crazy. Of course it does, because that's the only way you get through a rational impasse, something that sounds a little crazy, right? Well, that's why it's non-rational. So the idea of having children at very early age, and this is the thing, you're going to have the technology to do the translation. You could say the big problem was having like translation. How do you speak with kids of other languages? You're going to be able to deal with that a lot more, right? And so by having that sort of interaction as a regular dimension of people's lives, that's going to allow people to stay in their culture and their religion, but also develop empathy, as opposed to growing up like just in their reality tunnel till they're like 20 and then interacting with people of other cultures. Well, then they're too solid, right, to be able to do this kind of mobility of awarenesses between different frames. So though that would be something I would like to see at non-rational training very early on. And I think conversation is basically the strongest form of non-rational interaction, not just having the, you know, not just having the kid from the other religion do a show and tell on their different beliefs. No, regular interaction on a personal level that unveils that they're a human being too, in their very difference, and you can interact with that and transform your frame of thinking about the world. And now you're less vulnerable to rational impasses. And if we do not do that, we probably will not overcome these rational impasses until the day when it's too dire to move on.
That's the full circle to unity, the way that I was talking about unity at the start, though. So that's the emotional proximity, right? So this is how you facilitate the emotional closeness required, in my mind, for what unity is. Unity is not everyone staying in their little corner and not interfering with one another and just being quiet and getting along somehow. It's active. You need emotional proximity without, you know, everyone signing up to it in such a way that it's not about domination or devouring or annihilation or take, you know, it is. And so, and doing it in, you know, at that stage when they're children takes into account the developmental part as well. That's exactly what is needed. There was one other thing I was going to say in response to something that was said prior about how to provoke, you know, how best to provoke this, I can't remember what it was, different way of being something. And I guess my mind there just briefly goes to what I do in my form of therapy, like to really provoke someone into going through the intense challenge of doing something very difficult that they've been avoiding for so long, is you really need to intensely highlight the costs to them, and much more so than some like motivational interviewing kind of way. Like, you need to show them the horror of what is happening if you remain in this way. You need to really highlight that for them, because there's all sorts of ways that people minimize that. We all do it. Society does it as a whole. Everything, you know, you need to really show them the horror of what is happening and what will continue to happen if not. Like, just bring it into stark reality for them so that they can't look away. And that requires an amount of pressure. So I think that's important too. There does, and maybe that ties into a little bit of this acting crazy kind of thing that we're talking about. Like, there's an element of making people uncomfortable and bringing some kind of shock into the system. But based on something that is really happening, but everyone is just sort of pushing underground because it's just, everything's nice and quiet right now. We don't need to look at it now. So yes, that lacks any of the lovely philosophical language, but hopefully that means something. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Aspasia. I think we need to look at bringing this to a close now, and thank you Daniel, and if you have to take off, please feel free. Seems, relating with unity as a verb rather than something static, that seems to be something key that's, let's say, come through. I feel like that was sort of known in a sense. And the other thing which this brings up for me, just in closing, that I will certainly be taking away is the challenge of communication, because in hearing, you know, Daniel speak at the end there, that to me just seems so totally rational. And he's going, well, if this sounds absurd, it doesn't sound absurd to me, it doesn't sound non-rational, it sounds super rational. And so maybe it sounds irrational to someone coming at it from a different perspective. And so it seems like we're constantly needing to discern, in fact, whether or not where we're speaking from is already, we're already in attunement with that whole. We've already gone through that whole making cycle. Anyway, yes, I would like to bring this to a close, and perhaps we can just share some final thoughts with each other. Well, no, we'll do it now. I know we've already gone 30 minutes over time. That's all. So I want to be respectful to that and give you guys an out here, but I also don't want to cut you off from sharing anything for the sake of the recording. So if anyone feels like they strongly desire to have something shared in the context of the recording, then let's open a bit of space for that. If not, then I'll hang out for 5-10 afterwards just to decompress if anybody would like to.
I'll just briefly add on that topic. Rationality has always confused me anyway. I don't really understand it properly as a tip. Like, I mean, I've tried so hard. And I think I struggle in the same kind of way. I think I understand what it means, but then I hear someone use it and it's counter to how I'm viewing something. I struggle with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've found that the rationality in the sense of the etymology of ratio, the kind of rationing of resources, someone like Vivekananda will speak about that in his early lectures. So a kind of rationing of resources, or in that sense, it could also be a logical action taken within the context of a game where there can be that move made or that move made within the frame of logic in the context of, like, why be motivated to do anything at all, which is always kind of, maybe there's a test someone's giving you. Maybe it's a normative thing to do in the context of the culture, right? Maybe you're trying to build a house and you know certain things about physics, or just through your own experience and know certain things about the wood and what are all the materials. And so you can kind of make movements in consideration of kind of what is known with respect to a well utilization of those resources, but given a particular set of framings. And then this non-rational, the way Daniel's speaking about it is, well, sometimes we settle into Nash equilibriums of kind of like impasses, he said, impasses of rationality, where in some important sense, continuity of being here at all is disenabled by that impasse. So it's rock and a hard place type thing. And so, well, is there the possibility for a reframing? And they plug in notions like wisdom, the transcendent, a whole bunch of things, which, you know, the non-rational is not a new category as such, but the way he's speaking about it in terms of the true is not the rational is just, I mean, I think it is for many, many people. I think that will be very, very helpful. And so I'll certainly be calibrating various other perspectives and frameworks that come with their own language about rationality and cognitive science, as well as transcendent mythical experience. And myths already in some sense present us with a relationship between the rational and the non-rational in a way that we can metabolize as in some sense entirely rational with the set with from the perspective of, should we share this story with children, right? And so yes, there's such a flow to this. There's always a flow, and it's cross-contextual in terms of like whether something's rational or not, or, you know, it's obviously irrational, but then non-rational. Anyway, let's bring to a close there. Thank you, everybody, for being here.